Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. In this episode, I talk with Larry Cunningham, now a special counsel in Mayor Brown's New York office. Larry is a member of the firm's capital markets and public companies and corporate governance practices, where he advises public companies and boards of directors in those areas and advises investment managers and shareholders on investor relations. Larry is a Henry St. George Tucker III Research Professor of Law Emeritus at George Washington University. This is his second appearance on my podcast. The first time was on episode 36 in June of 2021. In this podcast, we talk about his recent transition to private practice after 30 years of teaching and some of the takeaways from the speech he delivered earlier this year for the 37th annual Francis Pillegy Distinguished Lecture in Law at Delaware Law School to the state's corporate bench and bar. We also tackled some current trends, such as the director's role amid debates over corporate purpose, stakeholders, and ESG. We also addressed the Silicon Valley Bank collapse and the ongoing financial crisis, and his advice for boards who have been or could be affected on the fundamentals of governance amid this heightened uncertainty. Finally, we talk about another recent article that he wrote in defense of share buybacks. If you like the show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. You can find all the show notes on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com. Larry, it is great to see you again. Thank you very much for coming in to the Boardroom Governance podcast to talk about what's going on in corporate governance. There's a lot of different situations now with the Silicon Valley Bank collapse and the financial system as a whole, not only in the US, but in Europe and the rest of the world. Things have changed a lot, but most importantly, now I see that you've also moved your special counsel to Mayor Brown. Congrats on the move. Tell us more about what you've been up to. You were in the episode 36 in June of 2021, in the heyday of the market, right? So now things have changed quite significantly, and that will give us a lot of thoughts, a lot of discussion on how to think about some of these issues that are going through the market.
Well, thanks, Evan. It's always great to be here with you. And yeah, when I was here last, I guess almost 2 years ago, I was just finishing up my tenure at George Washington University. I've been in university teaching for 30 years, and I just, you know, in corporate governance, we're always talking about term limits or age limits, or, you know, is the person still the best fit for the job? And I think we should ask ourselves those questions too. And I just appreciated that, as I think I had a good run in the classroom and in scholarship, but it was time for a pivot. So I went back into private practice just starting late last year. And, you know, it's great. It's still the same subject matter. It's still corporate governance. I'm advising clients, counseling boards, especially on governance related matters. And, you know, all the fun, exciting, thorny issues that you get into. But now it's, you know, it's kind of a very practical, very hands-on, very dynamic. So that's fun. There's continuity too. I'm also asked to do a lot of thought leadership. So that includes hosting events and inviting guests to talk, as well as writing. So we have a blog called Across the Board, and I write a weekly column for that, usually with one of the associates in the practice group. And it's fun because these are shorter pieces, more focused, and, you know, there's, you know, a cadence to it that I really enjoy. You know, I will probably still publish the occasional law review article, but I like the need or the sort of the role of writing regular pieces on, you know, the current state of things. So it's a lot of fun.
All right. Yeah. And I have read quite a few of those articles, and we'll discuss some of them in this podcast. But you also recently delivered the 37th annual Francis Pillegy Distinguished Lecture in Law at the Delaware Law School for the state's corporate bench and bar. What was the message you delivered, and what takeaways can you share with us?
My principal message was that Delaware is doing a very good job, and I told the judges and lawyers to please keep it up. The central point I emphasized was Delaware's tailored approach to corporate governance, the made-to-measure quality, where the statutes are mostly enabling. That they have some required provisions. You have to have a board, for instance. But most of the details can be written to suit the needs of a particular company. There are very few prescriptions and mandates because of a belief that one size does not fit all. And so I encourage them to continue that tradition. And likewise, on the judicial side, the judges, as you know, as listeners will know, are fluent in corporate governance and in business generally, and understand the dynamics of corporate life and board life. And when they confront a case, a disagreement between litigants, they are very thoughtful, empathic, understanding, and sophisticated. They write very thoughtful, detailed opinions, attentive to the pivotal facts. They use very well-understood doctrinal frameworks to balance contending interests, and they usually get it right. And so I applauded them for that and encouraged them to keep that up. And I emphasize that because I think there are strong countercurrents in other streams of governance that promote a one-size-fits-all approach. And those streams include the Securities Exchange Commission that it's the tradition in federal securities regulation tends to be one-size-fits-all. In terms of the content of a 10K or an 8K or what has to be discussed in an MD&A. But in the past 5 or 10 years, the SEC has increasingly, gotten into the boardroom into governance matters, most recently, especially in the cybersecurity proposal, proposed regulation, and the climate disclosure regulation, both of which have provisions that require companies to describe their board's engagement on those topics, whether they have a director who is an expert in those topics, and whether and how that expertise came to be, and how often they talk about these topics. And I find this to be a very one-size-fits-all approach, and contrast with the Delaware approach. A second stream of one-size-fits-all governance comes out of the Big Three index asset managers, BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, who, because they own a bit of stock in every company, they promulgate very general one-size-fits-all governance standards on everything from board independence to committee meetings and staggered boards, cumulative voting, and you name it. And they've got a very they claim that they'll take a tailored look in particular companies, but in general, they promulgate broad gauge rules.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because you really focus on who are the quality shareholders and why you should care. And it's interesting when we talk about shareholders, because there are some of these indexers, the large institutional investors, but you also talk about transients and activists and quality shareholders. Why don't we talk about the different typologies? Because let's make that clear. A lot of the listeners may be directors, and this structure that you've developed, and this is part of your academic literature, is trying to figure out, what are the types of shareholders that you want in your cap table? How does that make a difference? So maybe can we talk about the typology that you've developed?
Yes, thank you. I did write quite a few large articles exploring aspects of shareholder demographics. And I owe a lot of the intellectual debt to Brian Bushy, an accounting professor at Wharton, who has written even more about shareholder types. And in general, and others have used his work and mine a bit to elaborate. And the basic framework appreciates that shareholders have very different time horizons. Some are very short term, nanosecond traders, or even by the month or by a year or less. Others hold forever. 10 years, 20 years, 30, and you have investors all across that time horizon. And likewise, investors differ in their degrees of concentration versus diversification The large index funds are extremely diversified. They have thousands and thousands of stocks in a portfolio, or even if they've got specialized indexes, there's still many, many, many hundreds. Whereas at the other extreme, there are stock pickers who may only hold a dozen, 20 stocks, or at least that would be the dominant part of their portfolio. Berkshire Hathaway is a famous example at that end of the spectrum. And if you take these two different axes together, the time horizon and degree of concentration, you'll get a typology of four types of shareholders. The index funds, which are very highly, they're very long term. They basically plan to hold forever, but they never focus. They're always fully diversified. The transients, who are extremely short term, although they may concentrate, they may do arbitrage positions on a very small number of stocks, but they're always in and out. And then activists, which are some sort of a combination, and there's a lot more variety there, but they will very often tend to have very large stakes, but not being permanent holders. And then there's this fourth quadrant, those who are focused as well as long-term. That's the Berkshire Hathaways of the world, and those are called quality shareholders. And the reason, so these are the four quadrants, if you like, and every company will have a mix of different densities of these four types of shareholders, and they each contribute something. They all have some value. Index funds enable millions of people to get the market return at virtually no cost. The short-term transient traders make a market. They contribute to the depth and liquidity of the market. They help form prices. Activists obviously promote accountability, but they all come with downsides. So transients can evoke or induce a short-term focus. Indexers, tend to favor a one-size-fits-all approach. Activists sometimes get carried away. And the quality shareholder cohort tends to offset all of those drawbacks. They're long-term, they're focused, and they tend to conduct any kind of engagement very quietly and diplomatically behind the scenes. Their main drawback is that they sometimes are wrong. They make bad judgments about the quality of a company or the economics. But, and from a company's point of view, these types of shareholders offer different things. And, I spent a lot of time in my articles and books explaining, what some of the advantages to a board and to managers are of having a lot of quality shareholders, a high density. It includes things like having a sounding board, having a quiet diplomatic partner to confer with about matters of corporate life, capital allocation, acquisitions, divestitures, dividends, and whatnot. Also, very many boards have found good directors among their long-term focused shareholders. And
let's talk a little bit about that, because one of the things that Warren Buffett has always emphasized, and I think it's lost in this governance debate, and you've written, of course, about Warren Buffett's annual shareholder letters. And in many letters, he mentions that the attributes of directors has to start with business savviness. And every other aspect of a director kind of follows through from that. Can we talk about the focus on directors and in governance itself with this different framework? One of the things that I thought was really interesting is that you took a list of these PAT formulas that exist in terms of what is considered today good governance, and you put an 11-pronged approach reflecting a typology of the index funds of what they think is wrong. So, for example, the classic one, the board chairman should not be CEO. The board should have a majority of independent directors. The standard board committee should have only one or should have only independent directors. At least 30% of directors should be other than straight, white, and males. And we can go on and on. And so it's interesting because you kind of talk and write against this kind of trend. And I think for anyone who's on the board, these are very important elements. So let's talk about qualities of directors and then these PAT formulas versus, I would say, case-by-case scenarios.
You've hit your finger on the question, which is, whether decisions should be made by a central command that announces the correct results for everyone concerned, or at a company-specific level or director-specific level that is tailored to suit. You know, and the great thing about Delaware is it always operates at that level of specificity. It's always very company-specific. Every company is different. Every board can be different. Every director can be different, so long as they operate faithfully and loyally and with care. And I think the problem that is plaguing corporate governance is instead you have central coordinators like the SEC or the proxy advisors or the big index firms announcing what everyone has to be like. And that includes that list that you've just given. And it just can't be the case that every company has to have a separate chair and CEO. That's best for every single company. It's just hard to imagine that's always true. It depends entirely on the personalities of the people involved, the histories, their commitment, their relationship, the type of industry, the type of business, the demographics of the shareholder base. Depends on an infinite variety of things. So that's my central concern about prevailing norms or the ecosystem is we have top-down mandates that are one-size-fits-all, when in fact the world is quite different. It's a diverse group of companies, boards, and people. And to come back to your point, you know, Warren Buffett has always said, and I've repeated and written up his views on board selection and what is a good director. And you hit the nail on the head. Being business savvy is the number one requirement. That's what's most important. These are corporations whose boards we're talking about. They're in business. So to have, you know, and our board is charged with overseeing the business and affairs of the corporation. So being good at business has to be the number one thing. And then caring about that particular company, having some reason and motivation to be interested in the board of ABC company or XYZ company. And I think in the current environment, again, I think lip service is paid. Certainly the boards are looking to add people who understand the business and care about it and will do a good job. That's still on the agenda. I think search firms are, you know, try carefully to do that. But it's not, you know, Warren always puts it as job number one. I worry that it's not always put as job number one in today's top-down kind of environment.
So in today's environment, the mantra, and I've kept saying this in many episodes, and it shouldn't be a surprise anymore, is ESG. Environmental social governance is sort of become very prominent, pervasive, and you recently wrote an article on what is the director's role amid some of these debates that are not only on ESG, but it's corporate purpose, it's stakeholder capitalism. There's a lot of changes, right, since at least 2019 with the Business Roundtable coming out with a restatement of the purpose of the corporation. But let's talk about ESG and how should boards think about their role. Has anything changed? And you write that there's something that is very clear, at least very clear in Delaware law, which is to whom you owe your duties. And the reality, you say, is simple and subtle. Directors' legal duties run to shareholders, but directors may promote the interests of others when those are rationally related to shareholder interests. Why is that not more kind of known around it? You know, people have a lot of debates around this, but the law seems very settled.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think there has been an enormous amount of noise and static around this this movement and the counter movement that it's provoked. And if we had just not allowed the noise to rise, we wouldn't have had all this trouble, and we could stick with the basic point that you just made. Delaware law requires corporate directors to act in the best interest of the corporation and its shareholders, period. They're not required by that duty to act in the best interest of any other stakeholder or constituent, never have been. They're permitted to do so, and sometimes it might be necessary to do so in order to advance the shareholder interest, but there's not an independent duty. And I'll tell you, the perfect example just came out 3 weeks ago in an opinion from the Delaware Court of Chancery called McDonald's 2, Vice Chancellor Laster granting defendant director's motion to dismiss a Caremark oversight claim where the allegations were that the board had failed to respond to red flags of a corrosive sexual harassing environment. The court agreed that the plaintiff had made out a case that there were lots of red flags, but he also said that the board responded in good faith to them, so dismissed the complaint. But in the course of his opinion, there's this wonderful syllogism, a wonderful passage basically the shareholders are alleging the board allowed the company to mistreat the workforce. That's very interesting because it's claimed by the shareholders that the workers were hurt. And what this wonderful passage explains that the directors owe their duties to their shareholders. And in discharging the duty of the shareholders, they've got to make sure that the work environment is safe. They cannot condone leadership that creates an environment that's hostile, that's unsafe, that's unfair, that condones or promotes sexual harassment. So in that setting, the directors actually have an obligation to take reasonable steps to assure that management is maintaining a safe workforce. And if there are problems that, you know, that make it unsafe, whether from sexual harassment or otherwise, that's a director's problem. So it's a beautiful syllogism, and it has nothing to do with ESG. In lots of ways, the noise, the elevated contentiousness around ESG has I think absorbed lots of resources. I'm just not sure what particular end. I mean, there's a soft version of ESG that I had thought made lots of sense and had always really been incorporated into the best management investment philosophy. So that when in 2005, when the UN promulgated this idea of ESG, it looked to me like very familiar territory. And just in the last several years, it has been redirected and reoriented to a much higher, much different place. Often a very political one, and the result is a predictable backlash that is also political. And to me, you know, just from a pure governance standpoint, from advising directors, being a director myself, there's a lot of distracting and costly noise. And we have to, I think, bracket it, put it to the side, and stick with our knitting, and stick with the business of governance. So I mean, that said, there have been enormously powerful forces in back of a lot of the agendas. And some for excellent reason. The environmental aspect, there is serious need to constrain emissions, and it's a big, huge problem and requires, enormous effort to solve. And so it's naturally crept into every part of the civilization. And so, directors obviously have to incorporate that. But again, I think we always have. I think in the 1970s, as the EPA and the ecology movement began, companies were paying attention to this, starting with DuPont. In some ways, it's not brand new at all, but maybe the magnitude is different, and the pressures are certainly different.
Yeah, one of the... It's interesting that the way that in your article you put some of the reasons for the increase in debate, and you say, look, there's been a big decline in trust of government. There's, as you just described, a big rising concern about climate change. There are powerful social movements that are happening. And there's also powerful institution asset managers leaning on ESG, right? There is the big three, big 12, right? As you know, there's academic literature saying, hey, if today these big three own about 25% of the Fortune 500, maybe in 10, 20 years, they're going to own 40%. At what stage they're going to actually, a band of few people, a dozen people, control what corporations do? And that's very concerning. Charlie Munger, right, also said it very clearly in a recent annual shareholder meeting that he was very concerned about some of these indexers. And none other than Jack Bogle, before dying, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying, look, this is a big danger and we have to restrict the power of these indexers. So I think it's interesting. It's a confluence of issues that are very big, but, you know, has the law changed? Unclear.
Yeah, certainly the state corporation law in Delaware has not changed. The fiduciary duty is owed to the corporation and its shareholders. I participated in a debate in November in Philadelphia at Directors and Boards magazine. I debated Jeff Sonnenfeld from Yale about the purpose of the corporation. And during the day, it was a full day of panels. And one of the panels featured Andy Bouchard, former vice chancellor or chancellor of Delaware and now a partner at Paul Weiss, who gave us a beautiful 7-minute account of the history of Delaware corporate law and its current framework. And he emphasized that Delaware is a shareholder primacy state. And I nodded agreeingly. And what struck me the most was Bouchard then had to say, and that's a good thing. So the law of Delaware is the same as it's been for 100 years. And my speech down there was to congratulate them and encourage them to maintain that tradition. And most other laws have not changed all that much. There have been tightening of environmental laws worldwide. There have been enhanced focus on human rights and supply chain management and, you know, other sort of issues under S, workforce diversity and safety and so on. So there have been legal changes around these topics. But and the SEC, as I said, in the United States has moved inched into the boardroom in some ways. And so, yeah, there are certainly changes in the conversation. There are changes in some of the behaviors. But the core duty of the director has not changed. And, you know, the thing that I'm most interested in being sure of as we see, you know, as I talk to board members, as I talk to directors, and I see new board members coming in. I'm on a few boards. I help with onboarding. I like to remind colleagues that their duty is solely to the corporation and not to themselves. I remind them your personal values don't matter at all in the boardroom. In fact, if you put your personal values ahead of your corporate interest, you're violating the duty of loyalty. And so the reason I emphasize this, Evan, is when you talk to people, employees, customers, prospective partners in business, you know, everyone's very interested in whether this organization's values align with mine. There's a very heightened focus on one's own personal values, so much so that people use that in decisions about whether to join this company or buy this product. And so I think it's important to remind directors that that's not a freedom they have. They are not entitled to elevate their personal values over the corporate values. You know, the perfect example of where that will come up a lot this month is in the 14A8 shareholder proposal area, where now the SEC staff is permitting shareholders to put on the ballots topics that have policy significance, even if they don't have significance to a company. And so, you know, you've got proposals on every public policy topic imaginable, from abortion to zoning. And I'm telling, you know, directors, when they evaluate these proposals, whether to include them, whether to try to exclude them, how to interpret the vote, their personal views on abortion and zoning are completely irrelevant. And they may not use them in evaluating what's best for the company. And to me, that might be one of the biggest challenges that the coming generation of directors is going to have to wrestle with. But again, in that McDonald's case, the chancellor was also quite clear in several passages on exactly this point, emphasizing that you have to act for the corporate interests. You can't let your own personal beliefs, views, attitudes, and preferences intrude on your business judgment.
Yeah, that's really important. I'll add the decision in the show notes for those that want to later read about him. But let's talk now about the Silicon Valley Bank collapse, the ongoing financial crisis. There's been a lot of bank failures. Silvergate, Signature, First Republic is kind of stumbling. Credit Suisse has just been acquired by UBS. What is your advice now for boards who have been or could be affected on the fundamentals of governments amid this heightened uncertainty, right? And this is, again, thinking about what are your duties amid this environment. You also wrote an article, I'll put it in the show notes, with your colleagues and partners at Mayer Brown. But maybe you can describe what you're advising clients in this environment. And it's a very fast-moving environment, and we will see for sure a lot of litigation come out of this because the losses have been tremendous, and we don't know how much it's going to impact. In fact, the impact, I think, is only beginning, certainly in Silicon Valley. I mean, Silicon Valley Bank was a massive player in the ecosystem of tech. Without them, it's going to impact all the startups. And so I think we're only in the beginning of what's going to happen in the future.
Well, thank you for that that reference to that client alert that we issued at Mayer Brown. After the weekend of the collapse, we spent the weekend together working on it. And we tried to think deeply about how customers of those banks or other collateral partners or down the chain companies might be affected. And then to think hard about how those leaders of those companies, the officers and the directors, you know, might prepare themselves for challenging decisions they might face. So we try to take a sober look at the boardroom amid financial uncertainty or market queasiness, and we do think, well, at least I should say, I think that the problems that we were worried about that weekend may have subsided to a significant degree, thanks to the government intervention and the private sector intervention. But I think that the kinds of uncertainty that existed for at least that week are recurring. That they can come again, whether due to this current problem in the banking sector or from other reasons. And so we wanted to provide a review of how boards operate best when they're facing conditions of economic or business uncertainty. And so we review the basic duties of care and business judgment and of loyalty and good faith, but then emphasize it, in a setting where difficult decisions are being made. To take an extreme example, prioritizing the use of limited cash when you're in a liquidity crisis, you will be second guessed. That people will complain. When we operate the ordinary course and no particular trade-offs are manifest or visible, we get business judgment rule deference from the markets and the constituents and from the courts. But in times of limited resources and prioritizing, expect to be second guessed. And so we encourage people simply to prepare to defend their decisions, not as ordinary business judgments, but as entirely fair, as decisions that would meet that heightened standard of scrutiny that markets and judges might apply, that insist that the directors show that they made not only an informed business judgment, but also a fair decision given all of the considerations. And second, companies in challenging circumstances may face solvency questions. And we want to emphasize that, in the ordinary course, directors and officers owe their fiduciary duties to the corporation and its shareholders. And the violation of those duties can be challenged by shareholders in court in direct or derivative cases, not by other constituents. But that changes for companies that are insolvent. They other claimants would have standing to sue as well, particularly creditors. And so, again, we when they our advice was that for directors facing questions of that magnitude, the potential solvency risk, they ought to go on heightened alert that their decisions may be challenged not only by shareholders but by creditors, and that their job then is to really look out for the best interests of the corporation taken as a whole.
Larry, let me ask you one question there, and it's not U.S. law, but one of the very eye-opening things that happened is in the case of Credit Suisse, the government decided to wipe out a type of creditor with a new law that they passed that same weekend, and without a shareholder vote, you know, the merger between UBS and Credit Suisse. And I thought that was really interesting from a corporate governance perspective, right? Like suddenly the government passes a law that I'm sure there's going to be a lot of litigation around that, but I'm not sure if you've been following that case. Certainly, the Credit Suisse takeover is a much bigger story in terms of weight and history. It's a 167-year-old bank. You know, Silicon Valley Bank was only around, I think, since 1984. But what's happening in Europe is a much bigger scale and very interesting from a corporate governance perspective. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of litigation around that decision too.
It's a very difficult, it's a vexing circumstance. And but the idea of you know, of having a sovereign intervene in a corporate matter and effectively eliminating shareholder rights, in that case, a right to vote on a business combination, or of the class, that the economic rights of that class that was wiped out. It does happen, and you know, I recall 2008 in the United States when the Federal Reserve of New York, the Treasury, and the Federal Reserve of the United States all decided that the only way to unfreeze the capital markets and get capital flowing was to take control of AIG and use its balance sheet, use its cash to pay off the claims of 14 other international banks. That's what they needed to do. You know, AIG had written all of these credit default swaps, and so it owed these counterparties enormous sums of money. But AIG itself was having, you know, massive credit problems. And so what those government authorities did was take control of AIG. And the way they did that was acquire new preferred stock in AIG in exchange for, you know, an infusion of capital. The problem was that the AIG charter didn't have enough authorized but unissued shares to make the math work for the government takeover, and so that would ordinarily require a shareholder vote. Well, the shareholders wouldn't have voted for it, so they did a reverse stock split, which didn't, you know, the board alone could do, and the shareholders didn't get to vote, and then voila, they had enough shares to do the deal, and you know, they took over AIG. So it's hard to second guess. I mean, whether the current Swiss case or that U.S. case, you know, government actors are working under conditions of extreme pressure and uncertainty. And, you know, trying to protect everybody's rights is difficult, I guess I would say. And you're definitely, as you say, lots of litigation will ensue, and challenges will be made. Back in the AIG case, the shareholders did sue. They brought several different lawsuits. They ultimately all were not successful. But I would not want to be in the position of those government leaders effecting that kind of a takeover.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And as we go through, you know, there's a lot of talk that there's hundreds of insolvent banks. And so interest rates are a big issue. It's become very tenuous. And we should kind of monitor what's going on. And it's sort of a day by day scenario. You've also recently written about share buybacks. You cited Warren Buffett's latest letter, who used a very pointed phrasing, saying that when you are told that all repurchases are harmful to shareholders or to the country, or particularly beneficial to CEOs, you're listening to either an economic illiterate or a silver-tongued demagogue, characters that are not mutually exclusive. So obviously, share buybacks have been under the political gun, and you kind of make a defense of share buybacks in your latest memo there. Why don't we talk about that and why you thought it was important to bring this up again?
Right. This is, I guess it goes back a little to the theme that we began with around one size fits all versus tailored governance. Because the main point that Warren makes there and that I made is that contrary to that that claim that some political leaders make that all buybacks are bad, that's just not true. Some of them are, some of them aren't. Some of them are very good. Some of them are just right. It depends. And so I worry that the political class has found incentives to paint with a broad brush. And so President Biden, Senator Warren have announced that all corporate share buybacks are bad and they need to be taxed. And they say they're bad for the country. They're bad for employees. Some of them might even say they're bad for shareholders. And they're always good for executives. And these are just, these statements are simply too broad. It's just not so that all of this sort of transaction is bad. A lot of times it might be an unwise use of corporate capital. In some cases, it might be motivated more by improving the value of an executive's stock options by boosting the share price. It might be, I think the political critics complain a lot that somehow it takes money away from employees and gives it to shareholders. In some cases, it might well do that. On the other side, there are plenty of reasons to make a buyback, and a typical capital allocation model would say, first, you can do a lot of different things with corporate cash. The first way to deploy the cash is to reinvest in the business, to provide worker training or worker safety or even give raises. But that usually doesn't require or absorb 100% of the cash. And so you need to then look and see what the next best use is. And that's very often making an acquisition, add to an existing business to expand something or to pursue a new line of business. And again, not all of those opportunities that are value enhancing will absorb all the cash. And so you might then need to find another outlet, and a potentially good one is if your stock is undervalued in the marketplace and you can buy your own stock for a discount, by doing so increases the value to all of the continuing shareholders and gives the exiting shareholders liquidity that by definition, if they're selling, they want it. And then finally, if your stock is too highly priced, it's not an attractive thing to buy your own stock. Why? Then the next logical thing to do with the cash is to pay a dividend to stockholders, which is a traditional way of returning investment to them. Not all of them welcome that. Some people prefer to have the cash reinvested. So I just explained that that's a typical capital allocation framework, and there's if it's done properly, it's buybacks should be welcomed and encouraged, not demonized or attacked in that way. So, I just think politicians are not prone to nuance or subtlety. A lot of them, it's tempting as a political person to conduct grandstanding and exaggerate claims, and I think that that's what's happened here, and I think that's why Warren Buffett felt constrained to really call it out. He used unusually tough language there in characterizing those leaders. He almost never speaks in such pointed words as silver-tongued demagogue. I think that he's a business leader. He's an expert in this topic of capital allocation. He's written abundantly about the topic and tried to educate people. And so, he's spent a big part of his career explaining the subtleties and the details and why painting with a broad brush is just wrong. And so for this to become, I mean, it's become such a major topic that if President Biden, last year, the United States passed a new tax on all share buybacks of 1%. That's extraordinary. And then the president in his State of the Union, in a 90-minute speech, used a minute or two of it to say we should increase that tax to 4%. So, and again, that kind of tax policy implicitly condemns all stock buybacks, which suggests they all ought to be penalized in some way, at least taxed. And I'd say Buffett just, finds that so lamentable that we'd have this quite irrational tax policy and political rhetoric that, he had to come out with pretty tough language.
Yeah. One of the things about that letter, and it's always great to read his letters, he writes that he's been investing for about 80 years, which is a third of the history of the United States, which is quite incredible. And I thought it's always remarkable to read his letters. But let me ask you another question about Warren Buffett. Obviously, he's always one of these investors that in times of peril, bankers try to get for capital, and there's been talk about private jets flying to Omaha and White House discussions. What do you think he's doing? He's probably got some cash lying around there, and I assume that he is willing to invest if the price is right.
That's spot on, Evan. My quip is that what Warren is doing is he's waiting for the phone to ring with an attractive offer on the other end of the line. I mean, the president or the White House might call him also to get his advice or his sense of the state of things, and he's probably willing to do that. But in terms of transactions or investments, he's a fiduciary for the Berkshire shareholders. And going back to our earlier point, he is dedicated to the best interests of Berkshire and its shareholders. And so he is not going to deploy Berkshire capital to help the country or help some constituency. That's not his duty. His duty is to invest that capital for Berkshire as a company and its shareholders. And he will do that only when he considers the deployment to be in an attractive opportunity at a good price. And so when they call him, if they will say that here is the business, here's the trouble it's having, here's why it's fixable, he will be able to size that up in very short order, and then he will determine whether the price being offered is attractive, and it will have to be at a discount from intrinsic value. He almost never makes a purchase at intrinsic value or above. He insists on that margin of safety. And if that opportunity knocks, he'll seize upon it. You're right. They have abundant cash at Berkshire, 130 or more billion at last count. And this is exactly what happened in 2008 to 2010, when so many institutions, banks and many ordinary companies were having a very difficult time. And when they needed capital, they called Buffett. And in many cases, he said yes. He bought a big stake in Goldman Sachs, a big stake in Bank of America, stakes in Harley Davidson and Tiffany's, all of which proved to be remarkably astute. These companies were really no one would talk to them, no one would support them. And Warren knew that they were supportable, and he did make those investments, and so. If we get into that, we're not in that situation this week while we're taping this, but if we got into a situation like that, Berkshire would be there as an investor. But, he's not interested in bailing anyone out, put it that way. He's interested in making an investment for his stockholders.
In fact, and I may have missed this, but I'm not sure I've heard much about Warren Buffett or Charlie Munger saying anything pertaining to this crisis, have they?
No, not that I've heard, not publicly. They tend not to. They're not publicity seeking people generally. they've written a few op-eds. They have their annual meetings. They go on television to talk about their companies. But they're not talking heads, you know, generally. So I wouldn't read anything into it one way or the other. I think it's just not their style to be the announcer or the commentator as events evolve. And as you suggested, I do think they receive private phone calls, you know, all the time asking advice or for them to size up the situation.
All right. Well, Larry, any final thoughts for directors for this 2023? Is there anything that we missed that you think is an important message that we should provide to people listening?
I would remind every director, and I remind myself and my own colleagues, I'm talking about public companies now, not talking about civic organizations or clubs, but directors of public companies are stewards of a business. And what they're expected to do is act with business judgment. That's why we have the business judgment rule. And that should be their sole and entire focus. And they should do their level best to avoid letting their personal preferences play any role, and their level best to focus on business and not on political debates and social issues of the day. Hard as that is, especially in today's environment where there's so many pressures conspiring to get directors distracted in that way, I would try to stick to the knitting. The job of a corporate director is to exercise business judgment and leave the personal, political, and social values at the door.
All right. With that, Larry, thank you very much for your time again. It's great to catch up with you. Hopefully next time we talk, economy, the market is going to be doing better than what it is now. But I look forward to talking to you next. Thanks again.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for tuning in to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can just find me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Evan Epstein. You can also check out all the details related to this podcast on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com.